This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Well, as Japan is reeling from its earthquake and tsunami, what happens next? Dr. Ken Harrison is a disaster retrieval specialist who's worked on many disasters such as the Yogyakarta earthquake of 2006 and the Asian tsunami of 2004. Ken, thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, good morning, Katrina. How are you?
Not too bad. I mean, let's just start with this this tsunami. How does it compare to what you worked on in Yogyakarta in 2006 and as well as the Asian event of 2004?
Well, in Yogyakarta, there actually wasn't a tsunami. That was just earthquake damage.
Mm-hmm.
The earthquake did occur under the water just south of Yogyakarta, but there wasn't actually a tsunami. Where I was involved in was in the first medical team in the Pendarache after 2004, and I must say the pictures on the internet are just towns that aren't there anymore and just resemble piles of matchwood, exactly what we found in Pendarache. It certainly is the same level of kind of unbelievable destruction and wholesale wiping out of infrastructure that we saw in Pendarache that they're experiencing in those seaside areas of northeastern Japan.
So what did you actually arrive to when you arrived in Pendarache? What was it actually like being there on the ground?
It was a surreal experience. We arrived there, like I said, on the first medical team in, and when we had arrived, there was precious little way of any type of help happening. The big thing that Japan has over Pendarache is the rest of the country is all right.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Pendarache was concerned, that was the big town. That was all there was, really. And basically a third of the town had been wiped out. And when I say town, it's a city the size of Canberra, 250,000 people.
Mm.
That third had been moved by the tsunami into the second third. And that second third, the buildings were standing upright rather than completely destroyed, but were uninhabitable. When we arrived there, there was nothing. There was no water, no food, no infrastructure, and that's the big issue. There just is nothing left there. It is all in pieces.
So, what's the first thing that needs to be organised when you arrive on a disaster of this scale?
Getting some type of control back. We live in a society which is civilised. All human societies are civilised. And so that you need to have some basic controls, even before you start thinking about food and water. Who is in charge? What is happening? Where is it being run from? That is the first thing that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing that needs to happen is looking out for dangerous things that aren't immediately obvious. And for us, when we arrived in Pendarache, one of the dangerous thing we need to look after was our own water supply. There wasn't any. So we took with us a ton of water, all in little 350ml bottles.
Oh, wow.
We started that with our lives because if we lost that, there was nothing we could do. Likewise, every other team that arrived brought their own water for a long period of time, and that was absolutely essential.
What are some of the public health risks from a disaster like this?
In some ways, they're a bit overstated. There's always the bit that people are worried about, you know, you'll catch diseases and various other things. In some ways, that is true. In some ways, it's a bit overstated because that's actually further down the list. You are worried about clean water, and certainly if you don't get clean water to people soon, issues will happen, particularly ordinary diarrhea and nausea and vomiting and people getting sicker in that regard. But in terms of, you know, plagues of unbelievable illnesses sweeping through, that's actually reasonably unlikely. And in Japan, it is most unlikely. The big thing about Japan is whilst the areas that have been wiped out have been really, really devastated, the good news is once you go 15 kilometres inland, you've got relatively normal infrastructure to then start building back towards the coast on.
So would you say that being such a highly developed nation will really help them in this recovery?
Nobody is better prepared than the Japanese. The word tsunami is Japanese. We used to call them tidal waves. You know, we've adapted the Japanese fern. They have known about them for centuries. They have had them for centuries. They've also had earthquakes for centuries. The Japanese building code is amazing. The fact that, you know, there was precious little damage that happened from this, you know, 8 on the Richter scale earthquake. It all happened from the tsunami. And with the tsunami, they built sea walls, these enormous concrete walls. Just unfortunately, they were built for kind of 4-meter tsunamis, and this was a 6-meter tsunami, or whatever the levels were. I'm not 100% sure what it is. So certainly, Japan is better prepared than any other country for this type of thing, which just shows how bad it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ken, when you're in the thick of an event like that, what's it like on the ground, and what kind of pressures are there on the medical teams that are working there?
Fairly intense. First of all, one of the great things about Australia is that the land doesn't wiggle. Lots of other countries, the land moves. And when you're working in an area that's just had an earthquake, you can be sure there's going to be lots of aftershocks. And they by themselves, they are scary. You know, we had a 7 aftershock one night that just knocked us flat off our feet. And, you know, there's lots of dangerous earthquakes that haven't been at 7. And likewise, I'm sure that is happening to the teams over the minute, is just coping with the fact there are aftershocks. The second thing is, again, I'm sure the Japanese have got this worked out. Where do you fit into the scheme of things? You're not going to be able to save the entire world. You're going to be able to do a lot of good to the right amount of people if you put into an appropriate situation where you can do that. But what you have to do is to be able to organise it so that you are in an appropriate situation where, with the skills and the things you've got, you can actually take care of that and do what you need to do. I'm sure the Japanese will have organised it because they know what they're doing.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I know that in Banda Aceh you were involved in performing sort of emergency surgeries, and I imagine that you would have to be very choosy about who you do and don't help. So how do you work that out when there are so many people in need?
You work on the basis of which ones can I save and which ones can't I save, and that is a term that's kind of loosely curved, reverse triage. You actually use it very, very, very seldom. There was actually only one little boy who we gave reverse triage to in that time in Banda Aceh. We didn't get to Banda Aceh till day 3 because on the first day and a half, nobody in the world knew what was happening. And then it took us a while to get mobilised and get there. And one of the big things that's happened in the last 7 years since 2004 is we are better organised, everybody is better organised. You know, the Japanese basically asked for help internationally within a couple of hours of the earthquake. You know, they didn't wait, and that is the entirely correct approach. Mm-hmm. You know, get help, get appropriate help in there. And the team that's been sent over there, Urban Search and Rescue Team, is exactly what they need. But in terms of what you do in terms of emergency surgery, you work on which ones can I save and which ones are just too bad that it's just going to be too hard. This little boy we had was a little 11-year-old boy that I'm never going to forget. He was brought in on about day 4 or 5 from the west coast. His entire village had been wiped out. He was breathing very, very rapidly and working really, really hard to breathe because he had developed bad pneumonitis after tsunami. We measure a thing called oxygen saturation, which is the amount of oxygen that's in your blood that is saturated, and his was sitting on about 85% even on oxygen, which for a previously healthy 11-year-old boy is really, really bad. We gave him nebulized Ventolin, we gave him oxygen, we gave him antibiotics, but really what he needed was to be taken to an intensive care, intubated and ventilated, and had a tube put down his throat, anaesthetized, put in a coma, and basically been given intensive care treatment. We had all that stuff with us, we had sets of that, but we'd made the decision that we weren't going to use it, and with him, unfortunately, that was appropriate. If we had have done that, it would have taken one of our teams of 2 doctors and 2 nurses instead of doing 10 or 12 operations on people. All they would have done for the next day is look after him. Unfortunately, he passed away that day or that night, which is really unfortunate. Why I'm never going to forget him is because I've got 2 children, 1 boy and 1 girl, and his date of birth was the 31st of August, 1992, and my son was born on the 1st of September, 1992.
Mm. Wow, that's amazing.
Yes.
Very tough decisions to have to make in a situation like that.
It is and it isn't. You know, faced with the immediate need around you of lots of other people that need operations, it is surprisingly untough, and it is the correct decision. That's all you can do.
Yeah.
Like I have said, that is the only case of reverse triage that I've ever been involved. It's actually a pretty rare thing. It isn't a common occurrence, thankfully. And even if we had have intubated him, there's no guarantee at all that he would have lived. He still had an incredibly stormy course. If he had have arrived at a paediatric intensive care in one of the major cities in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. How well do you settle down again after an event like this?
I think having a supportive family, having a faith, having being able to get back into work, being able to come back to a country that doesn't wiggle, that's really important.
Mm.
And I also think being prepared, taking the correct stuff with you and knowing that, you know, you couldn't do everything but you did a good job is also really helpful.
Okay, well, thanks for sharing a little bit of your experiences today and shedding a little bit of light on what it's like for the teams in Japan.
That's all right. Hope that's been helpful, and thank you for your program. Listen to it often.
Thank you. That's Dr. Ken Harrison. He's a disaster retrieval specialist who's worked in many disaster zones, both in Australia and overseas.
This has been a Hope 103.2 podcast. For helpful articles, station news, videos, devotional emails, and more podcasts, visit hope1032.com.au.